Good morning and welcome to the Senate Revenue Committee. Today we have four bills on our agenda. House Bill 2027, House Bill 2103, House Bill 2278, and House Bill 2282. And all of these bills will be oriented to the committee by Elizabeth Maher, and we will go with House Bill 2027 to begin with. So, did you orient members of the committee to House Bill 2027?
All right. Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2027, and you do have a dash one amendment, but really the existing bill is the same as the dash one amendment. The dash one amendment is just clarifying a reference that needed to be brought into the bill in order to make it effective.
Ma'am, did we hear this bill earlier?
Mr. Chairman, this is the first time the Senate Revenue Committee has heard House Bill 2027. It did pass out of your House Committee on Revenue. So what this bill is doing is it's establishing a different lien date for personal property, which is removed from the county between January 1st and July 1st. And the tax lien for the personal property that is removed from the county between January and July, the lien date then becomes the day preceding the date of removal, sale, or transfer of the personal property. This does not apply to manufactured structures or floating homes, and we saw another bill that did that. Did this exact same thing for manufactured structures. This may sound familiar.
It does sound familiar.
Okay.
Eerily familiar.
That's right. And it begins tax year 2002-03. And so, again, the problem that we have since Measure 50 is you've got an assessment and a lien date, which are not the same. Prior to Measure 50, they were both July 1st. Now we've got assessment date January 1st and lien date of July 1st. So then there's a six-month period of time in which there could be an assessment on the property, but no lien. So if the property is removed from the county between that January 1st and July 1st, it can be difficult for the tax collector to collect all those unpaid taxes. So basically, with this bill, we're going to be helping not only the county tax collectors, but also the people involved in these sales of personal property and making it clear who will be paying the taxes. So as far as personal property, on average, there's about $3 million each year of uncollected personal property. And then after about 3 years, the county tax collectors can collect most of that $3 million with only about $326,204 on average that's remaining after 3 years. So one purpose of this measure is to reduce some of that uncollected taxes each year on personal property that is removed and to make it clear who is actually paying these property taxes at the time of a sale or removal from the county.
Thank you. Questions on the orientation from the committee? Hearing and seeing none, I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2027. Call Diane Self from the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. Ms. Self, this sounds like deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
Very similar bill to the one affecting the House Bill.
Very similar, other than we're actually now just dealing with personal property business. And I'll give you a little brief explanation, and then I'll talk about the dash one. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the personal property tax collector for Washington County. House Bill 2027 is the last of the tax collector bills, and we believe it's to help improve our customer service. It provides that the lien for personal property taxes attach on the day preceding the date that taxable personal property, which would be furniture, fixtures, and equipment, is removed from the county, sold, or otherwise transferred if that sale or transfer is between January 1 and July 1st of the assessment year. Prior to Measure 5, the assessment date and the lien date for personal property was January 1. Advance collections were done on personal property taxes from January 1 until the certification of the tax roll, and that was in October. Measure 5 moved the assessment date and the lien date to July 1st. If a business sold or closed after July 1st, an advance collection for pending taxes was done between that date and certification of the roll. Measure 50 separated the assessment date and the lien date to what we currently have now, and it has created a six-month period in which there is assessment but no lien. So if a business sells between January 1 and July 1st, there is no mechanism to determine the tax for the return that was filed by the seller prior to the sale. If the seller was late in filing their return, the purchaser may pay the penalty. If the purchaser fails to pay the tax, the seller will be held responsible for the January 1 owner. There are cases that I have experienced where the seller has actually paid the tax, even though it was the responsibility of the purchaser to avoid the judgment for the delinquent tax. Now, to make it a little easier on how this affects a taxpayer that sells or closes their business, here's a couple of examples, and this happens all the time. A taxpayer owns a business on January 1. As required by law, a personal property return is filed with the county assessor declaring the property in possession of the business on the assessment date of January 1. In March, the business is sold. In October, the seller receives the personal property tax statement from the county, and the seller contacts the county tax collector stating that the business was sold in March. Why am I getting this tax bill? The tax collector explains that the owner on January 1 is the owner of record, even though the lien does not attach until July 1st. So the seller, we instruct the seller to contact the purchaser of the property and ask that they get that tax paid. If the tax remains delinquent, then a warrant for the collection of personal property taxes is issued against the January 1 owner or the seller. If the seller of the property did not file the return on time, then a penalty is added to the tax. Now, does the purchaser pay this penalty, or is it the responsibility of the seller? Now, I did provide you a chart that kind of represents the current timeline for personal property. Now, in most cases, taxes are collected. The county does issue a warrant for the collection to enforce payment. And I've been told by a lot of taxpayers that have been caught up in this situation that they would have preferred to pay the tax at the time the business deal closed. House Bill 2027 will allow the county to work with title companies and attorneys that represent the buyer or the seller. With the lien attaching the day before the sale, the county will be able to determine the tax liability and penalty amount, if any, to help assist the person in the transaction, and they'll be able to prorate the amounts between the buyer and the seller. Now, in comparison, when you purchase a piece of real property at the time of closing, your lender may require you to pay your taxes in advance. This assures that at the time the tax bill is due, there are enough funds by your lender in your escrow to pay your taxes when they're billed. This alleviates any shortage in your escrow account. The same principle can be applied to personal property that is selling or closing. It ensures that the seller as well as the purchaser is treated fairly, and this bill will accomplish that. And I do have communication from Richard Spate's office, who's an attorney in Portland, and they probably handle over 300 transactions in a year, and that would be statewide. And they're encouraging that the committee look favorably upon this bill because it makes their job a lot easier. When everybody's down at the table, they're working with leases, they're working with the tax issues, and especially with the penalty. They want to be sure that the right people pay the penalty and that everybody is clear as to who and is taken care of at the time of the sale, so when the tax bills come around, there's no problem. Now, the Dash 1 amendment, it was brought to my attention here a few weeks ago by the Department of Revenue that the bill doesn't do exactly what I thought it was going to do, which also affects another bill that the governor's already signed, which was the manufactured housing bill, which was 2028. So it makes reference to a statute that gives us the authority to collect the tax. So that's what the Dash 1 amendment is about, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Byer.
Diane, you mentioned that the mobile home bill we passed does not. That's a problem, too?
That's, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, yes, because the reference to the statute that gives the tax collector the authority to collect that tax is not in that bill, and this will also correct that.
I guess I'd ask the department if that was a fatal flaw, Mr. Chair, my thought being that if that's an error, maybe before we pass this, we might want to just tack it on.
Well, let me understand from did you say that this also corrects that?
Does this correct that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, yes, it does. Takes care of the
whole.
It just takes care of it.
Piece of cake.
Questions? None. Let's go to work session. We're in work session on House Bill 2027.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2027.
There's a motion to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2027. Are there questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2027 as amended.
Colleagues, this bill has a minimal revenue impact, helps us collect about $1.1 million in uncollected taxes in the coming biennium, 1.23 in the next biennium. Great bill, fixes a problem. The motion is to move the bill to the floor with a success recommendation as amended. Any questions on the motion?
I'll fix it in the Senate.
Any discussion? Hearing seeing no questions. Is there objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. The chair will carry this boring little bill that nobody will listen to on the Senate floor.
And have me carry it.
I get away with a lot of them. You ought to see what we've done this list.
Yeah. Senator Corcoran will carry this bill.
Oh, sure.
Senator Minnis.
No, you're not.
Senator Minnis, your question.
It's not a question, just a comment. If we could get in the staff measure summary,
yes.
Kind of the timeline issue explained.
Yes.
As clearly as possible so that that I'm clear on what the timelines are. Are you concerned about the carrier of the bill?
Not at all.
No, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what the bill works and how the mechanics work in the site. So.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm sure the phone's going to ring off the hook.
The next, colleagues, I'm going to move to Senate Bill 2278, which is also in your packet.
The attorney's state representative in Munich. I say also.
Yeah, that's true.
Or is that the one that I wanted to hold on just a second here?
That sure lady looks off the lawn that I'm carrying the bill, but are you really going to carry it?
You asked for it.
I'm sorry, colleagues, let's move to House Bill 2282.
I'm just trying to confuse us.
I am, and it's working.
It doesn't take much.
Ms. Mahar, will you orient the committee to House Bill 2282?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2282, this is allowing war veterans up to 3 years of retroactive partial tax exemption if he or she has recently received a disability certificate from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. A war veteran has 6 months after receiving their disability certificate to apply to the county assessor's office for up to 3 years of prior partial tax exemption. So if the war veteran does not apply for the partial tax exemption within 6 months of receiving their disability certificate, he or she can still apply for the war veteran's partial tax exemption for current and future years, just not for those 3 prior years. So basically that 6 month period of time in which to get those prior years. This new retroactive section in House Bill 2282 only applies to war veterans during that 6 month period of time after they receive their certificate of disability. This really is trying to address an issue where the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs may take quite a while to actually give the certificate of disability to the veteran, and this is trying to allow them to have these partial tax exemptions for these years during the process. So basically, with this program, with war veterans, and with 40% or more disability, their partial tax exemption in 2001 is $9,020 of assessed value of their home or $12,020 of the assessed value of the home if the war veteran is 40% or more service-related disability. In 1999, legislature, they passed on House Bill 2040, which allowed the war veteran's partial tax exemption to grow each year annually. It's incremented now. And the income limits for the war veterans are $8,778 if a war veteran is without a spouse or dependent child, and $11,497 if the veteran has either a spouse or dependent child. And then $1,496 is added to the income for each dependent child. So basically, under current law, a war veteran can apply for the partial tax exemption after he or she has received a disability certificate and satisfies the requirements that are outlined in 307-250. So if a war veteran would have qualified for a partial tax exemption but had to wait several years, then to obtain the disability certificate, he or she would only receive a partial tax exemption in the current year. They don't get those prior years during the processing. So this is just trying to deal with that particular issue. And then as far as the effect, this shouldn't have a real large revenue impact. It's estimated that about 100 disabled war veterans would qualify for prior years of partial property tax exemption annually, and basically that would be about reduction of local property taxes of $42,000 in the 2001-03 biennium.
Questions on the orientation?
Is the purpose here, Elizabeth, that it takes a number of years from the time the veteran applies to get the disability. So this is covering processing time? That's what it's all about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Gives them basically up to 3 years if they were in the process.
The U.S. government does move quick.
Well, I see this relatively minimal effect at 40% service-related disability. Why do we have ones moving to 70% required?
Oh, okay. Senator George, let me talk about the Dash 1 Amendment. I don't know if you were here, wasn't it Tuesday, I think, this week? Yeah. So we had the same amendment, and what this amendment is doing is allowing Representative Witt brought these amendments, and we discussed this issue for one particular constituent of his. And in that particular case, on the House side, we have amended another bill, 2208, which is dealing with increasing this income threshold for war veterans and for all disabled people on the property tax deferral program. So in that case, it was this Dash 1 amendment is dealing with the property tax deferral program, not the veteran exemption. Yeah, even though it is talking about giving war veterans, it's eliminating them from the income requirement for getting on the property tax deferral program, mm-hmm. not this partial property tax exemption that war veterans get.
Okay.
They're two different programs, but with this Dash 1 amendment, Representative Witt was worried that we weren't going to address an issue of one of his constituents, so that's why he drafted this initially. It does have quite a large revenue impact, which we discussed 2 days ago. It's about $2 million additional payments that would need to be made to Department of Revenue for the war veterans that would come on the property tax deferral program. And so we have addressed Representative Witt's constituent issue in another bill, 2208, which you will be seeing soon, where we're just raising the income threshold for all disabled and seniors on the property tax deferral program from $27,500 to $32,000. So in essence, you can consider this Dash 1 amendment to 2282, but we have already addressed the legislator's issue for his constituent in another bill.
Okay. All right, so the question then, Elizabeth, would be, do we need the Dash 1 amendments to accomplish the objective?
Mr. Chairman, you do not need the Dash 1 amendments to accomplish Representative Witt's constituent issue.
Yes.
It's just an issue of how, you know, if you want to consider war veterans different from disabled war veterans different from other disabled individuals on the property tax deferral program.
Okay.
Which is not the same, obviously.
And you said there's how much in a fiscal impact?
$2.16 million in additional payments to the county beginning in July 1st, 2002. And this is from our last bill, House Bill 2347. We already passed out without that amendment.
$2 million impact. Revenue impact.
Yeah, it was about, I estimate about 1,730 war veterans annually would be able to come on to the property tax deferral program, and that's why you would need additional payments to the Department of Revenue initially for these additional deferrals.
So, Mr. Chair?
I'm Mr. Vice Chair.
If I might, to clarify, if we pass the bill as is, it has a minimal impact and can go straight to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
If we add the Dash 1 amendment, it will have to go down to the Ways and Means and stand in line with the other ones.
Exactly right.
And the Dash 1s are, I want to be real clear about it, the Dash 1s are in another bill also?
Actually, let us open the, let's ask some of the minister's question first, and then we'll open the public hearing and get a question. Senator Minister, question?
Well, the question, and maybe opening the public hearing since President Witt is here, but the question I had was whether or not these amendments were considered in the House. If not, why not?
Maybe we'll ask the people to bring in.
Yeah, let's ask, first of all, Representative Witt to come forward.
So much more fun.
And we'll open the public hearing on HB 2282.
So much more fun to discuss these things.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I appreciate your having a hearing on this bill. Of course, I brought House Bill 2282 primarily for a constituent who made me aware of a problem whereby his disability was not certified or recognized by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for more than 2 years after the point at which he actually became disabled. The certification was backdated to the date that he was eligible to be certified as disabled, but by the time he finally got the determination, more than 2 years had elapsed. And because of that, he lost out on the benefit of Oregon law relative to property tax, partial property tax exemption. So what this bill does, House Bill 2282, is it allows a person in that circumstances to go back 3 tax years and pick up the benefit of that partial exemption. And please remember that the reason for the delay is simply, as Senator Beyer pointed out, that sometimes it takes the federal government a long time to act and make these kinds of determinations. My constituent who had the concern is here in the room today, and he still has an interest in the Dash Ones. I think what staff is speaking to is we have another bill in the House that we've amended that goes from $27,500 to $32,000 as the maximum income that a taxpayer can make, a disabled or senior taxpayer can make, and still be eligible for a deferral on their property taxes. Current law has a maximum of $27,500 to become eligible for the program for the first time. But once you get into the deferral program, your income can go up to $32,000. What we simply did in House Revenue is we moved the eligibility up to $32,000. And if your income is less than $32,000 and you're disabled or you're a senior, you can defer your property taxes, not get away from them. You can defer your property taxes. And as long as your income doesn't go above that $32,000 in succeeding years, you can continue to remain on the program and defer the property taxes for succeeding years. I think the other thing we did, as I recall, is we indexed that for inflation so that people don't get pushed out of the program simply because of inflation. My constituent, Mr. Roach, who is here today, however, still believes the Dash Ones are necessary. And it would be okay, Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Roach can spend a couple minutes talking to the committee about that. I'd appreciate that. And I'm certainly here to answer any questions that any members might have.
Representative, would it be an honor to have your constituent address the committee, and we will do that. Senator?
Representative, the other bill, is it out of committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes it is.
Is it a House bill?
It is a House bill, and it is heading to the House floor.
With virtually no opposition?
I don't believe so. I think it will sail through easily.
And is it a vehicle that would be as good as this one to do that in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I think my constituent's concern is, as a disabled veteran, he thinks there's certain benefits under Oregon policy relative to disabled veterans that the Dash Ones would provide him that are not exactly parallel with the veteran with the property tax deferral program, which is the subject of the other House bill that is working its way through the process.
Is it clear that if we move this bill with the Dash One amendments, that we'll have to, as the Vice Chairman says, go over to the Ways and Means Committee and wait in line with the other
depot?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that that's true, because what we're talking about here is, and I don't know that we have a revenue impact on this, but I don't think this bill has any fiscal impact. It may have a slight revenue impact with the Dash Ones.
It actually is, I think, a major impact. Would it not be on local revenue? Where is derived the $2.16 million?
Mr. Chairman, it would be on state revenue, because the Department of Revenue is going to need additional funds in order to be able to first give property tax payments to the counties for these new participants in the deferral program.
Because the program, then the state reimburses the counties for the loss.
That's right.
State funds the counties.
And Mr. Chairman, we're talking here about the impact of the Dash Ones. Is that correct? Okay. I understand.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Minnis and then Senator Durr.
Question's still on the table. Why were these not considered in the House?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I don't think I was aware of the problem from this perspective when this bill came through the House. I was responding to my constituents' problem relative to this time lag between when the certification came down and when he was actually certified disabled, and I wasn't aware of this issue at that time.
Does the chair of the House committee consent to the amendment?
To the Dash Ones? I don't know. I don't believe I've discussed it with them.
Senator George has been very patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Witt, a question that isn't directly related to the bill but would help me to be informed about how this process works. If a person is eligible for the deferment and then their income rises above that cutoff level, are they then required to pay back those deferred taxes at that time?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, you simply cannot get that year's property taxes deferred. The taxes that had been deferred in prior years continue to be deferred, and there is a lien on the property that the state has, which they execute on the lien when the property is sold. But no, you don't have to pay back any prior year deferral. You simply don't get a deferral for that year.
Senator Corcoran, did you have a question?
Yes. I was just curious, Mr. Chair, I think I know the answer to this already, that there hasn't been a discussion with the co-chairs about the dash ones. I mean, there's no sense endangering a good bill, you know, if in fact it does. I mean, that's a pretty considerable hit, given what we're potentially facing about a week and a half from now. So I'm just concerned sort of politically about the survival of the bill if we attach the amendments.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I think that's a very good point. And maybe it is better to address this dash one issue in a separate vehicle.
Maybe after we've had a discussion with the co-chairs about the viability of it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
So that we get this through at least.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Corcoran has a valid point there. I mean, I'd hate to lose this bill because, you know, we put the dash ones in and it got tied up down in Ways and Means. So, I mean, I would appreciate it if Mr. Roach, who's my constituent, could spend a couple minutes talking to you about the dash ones. But if that becomes the judgment of the committee, I understand that, and I think that's a very valid point, and I would probably seek some assistance from Mr. Roach in a different vehicle.
Representative, we have a couple of opportunities. Let us hear from Mr. Bodenweiser, Mr. Roach, and Mr. McDonald, and if you'd refuse yourself to the side if we have additional questions, then we can talk to the folks from the Department of Revenue that will help clarify what the effect is. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Any order that pleases you, gentlemen. Yes.
Can I go? Okay, if I went first.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, people of the committee, I thank you for hearing this bill today. I originally started off talking to.
Yes.
Oh, my name is John Roach, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon.
Welcome.
I'm a little nervous. I went to Representative Witt with the basic problem dealing with a tax deferral or a tax, when you become 40% disabled, you have a break on your property taxes. It takes a long time for stuff to go through. You get it when you have a disability claim with the Department of Veteran Affairs. But a couple of other things happened, which I have to say a little personal things about myself. I'm disabled. I suffer with several problems. I was a salesman for 30 years and made a good living, but due to some problems, I've become disabled. And some of the things that I suffer with are post-traumatic stress. I suffer with fibromyalgia, and I suffer with diabetes. None of these things I would like to have, but I got them. One of the problems when something takes a while for it to go through on the end, they pay you in a lump sum. It's not recognized because the income it's considered for the year is all income. So if you file a claim and it takes 3 years to go through and they pay you retroactively for that claim, that amount of money puts you out of the bracket for being qualified for this disabled ability to defer your property taxes. Mm-hmm. Most of that wouldn't happen to me. I went ahead to pay back property taxes. When you become 70% basically disabled, the Veterans Affairs basically consider you unable really to work. With the problems I have and other people have with post-traumatic stress and different things, this affects cognitive thinking and also the ability to keep things in order. under the deferral program we have now, just to qualify for this, you'd have to show a copy of your federal Social Security benefits, a copy of a property deed, a copy of a tax statement, a copy of federal income tax for the previous years, a copy title, power attorney is just one, a copy of a trust, if there's a trust involved in doctor statements. I might look together here, but I'm a little shaky on the inside, and that's the same way it is with my personal records. This is really kind of overwhelming for me. People that are in a 70% bracket struggle. And I'm not saying that every person who had this ability would defer their property taxes. But, for example, I have two children which are under the age of 18. And when you look at certain things, like the medical bills for my children last year that I paid alone was over $2,000 plus. That's a lot of money when you're living on Social Security, you know, a 70% check. A lot of times where it sits, where it was said that the money has been raised to raise the cap, but what I would like to say, that's helpful and it's very good, but if you put it at 70%, it makes it just like the 40% on that bill. It makes it real clear and real simple for the veteran to do. It's not becomes a big obstacle trying to deal with a lot of paperwork and things that might be very difficult for them to put together. The other aspect, too, as I said before, when the county looks at the revenue for that year, even though the bill might be retroactive, or the claim might be retroactive for a couple of years, that puts you over the income for qualifying, too. So it's anybody that can keep their property tax clear would be smart to do it. All this 70% does is make it easy for a vet, if he's trapped between some financial problems, it gives him the right to do it. It doesn't say he has to take it. It just gives him the right to handle that pressure and make it real simple without being overwhelming with a lot of paperwork and a lot of other things you have to produce. I know I just run around trying to get the stuff to Washington County the first time trying to do this and getting the letters from the VA department and running around. It's a lot of effort, and what I have, even coming down here, it takes me about 2 days physically to recover from one trip down here. So that's why I asked for this, and that's why I think it's viable and important to have it in. And if I think if Mr. Witt had understood the whole thing at the time, he would have put this in to begin with. I didn't know it, so I went down there to try to apply for it, and he says, "You got too much money here." I said, "But I only got this much for this year. This is retroactive. I'm using it to pay my taxes." They said, "I'm sorry. You made too much money." So, they still got the money.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Roach, if only 1 year of that money had been considered and not the retroactive portion, would you have been eligible?
No, I would have missed it by $163. And believe me, I'd rather get the $163 back and be able to do this because it would help me. I mean, I struggle to keep this house. I've been in it 27 years. It's the home my kids are raised in. My daughter's coming 18 next year. She wants to come live there again. I am divorced, but I live very close to my children, and it would help her to go to school from that location easier than living way out in Alola. She wants to go to Portland Community College downtown, Portland State, and I don't know what to say. I think I don't think the numbers sound big for the physical impact, maybe, but not everybody's going to do it. I certainly wouldn't do it if I had a little more extra money. And there are veterans who are disabled that have businesses and things that they would normally pay the tax on it. This is just to help the ones that really need it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. That's excellent testimony. Gentlemen, your preference, sir? To add to the record, speak your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mac McDonald. I represent the Greater Salem Area Veterans, State VFW, and the Military Order of World Wars. I'd like to say that, first, the Veterans Administration is extremely slow in their giving a percentage of disability to any veteran. At the earliest I've ever heard is 3 years, and for mine it took 11 years because they lost my health records, and I had to go back and get statements from people in the service as to things that happened. As to the basic bill, each one of the organizations that I represent support the bill as it's written. As the Dash One Amendment, I can't comment on it because I just saw it for the first time this morning. But as to the basic bill, we urge you a due pass on this bill. Jeff.
Sir, I have to concur with your comment about their slowing. My father, who is a World War II veteran, someone had suggested that he could get assistance with his prescriptions. And so he contacted them in Eugene, their office, to schedule them. And they said, well, you have to come for an initial appointment. And they scheduled that appointment for not this summer, but next summer following. It was the first day they could get in.
Yeah, same thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, when I first got out of the service, I went to the Veterans Administration, and they gave me a 10% disability. It took 17 years for me to finally get the 90% disability, and I sleep probably 3 to 5 hours a night at the most. I'm up walking, trying to get rid of the pain.
My name is Jeff Bodenweiser, and I represent the Disabled American Veterans, the local chapter, and I do want to say that the support of the veterans is probably increasing, and I think that the idea of the long wait for the medical treatment is, and I'm really sorry to hear about the delay, and I think that the new clinic that's coming in at 17th and Mission here in Salem is going to reflect what the VA is going to do for people in this area, and Eugene is going to have a similar clinic that will shouldn't have that delay. And how long ago was that?
About a month ago.
And they have the new clinic in Eugene at the present time?
They've had it for about a year and a half.
I'm really sorry to hear that. As far as the impact of this bill, I think that as I see the bill as it's written, it seems to be the 2282 is with the service-connected disability, waiving that income requirement, it seems to be what is the point of the for service-connected 70% or more. Is that not correct in the basic bill? And this is what would go ahead without the Dash One, is that right? And the Dash One is the thing that would make it retroactive for 3 years? No?
Actually, that is the correct interpretation, but if you switch the position, the bill as you have it before us, as we have the bill before us, it would allow a veteran to be approved for a retroactive authority back to the date of disability. And this is a bill that has an excellent purpose, and I think the committee is fully in support of the bill as it exists. I guess what I would suggest that the committee consider is that we move the bill unamended as it is to the floor for passage, but that we connect with the other two bills that we have coming at us. We have a bill that Representative Witt will be carrying on the floor, I believe, today. It has the right relating clause that will be coming to this committee immediately following its passage from the House floor. And that will give us an opportunity to consult with the co-chairs of Ways and Means and discuss adding authority in their consideration of the whole budget for the $2.16 million in effect that this bill will have, because the state needs to be able to transfer dollars to the local government. And when we get that on the list of considerations, then we could move the Dash One amendments into the other bill, which is House Bill
2208,
and that will address the issue that Mr. Roach has brought forward.
Mr.
Vice Chair?
I wonder, I think that's a good strategy, but I wonder when the Department of Revenue people come up, I wonder if we've got the right, the least cost-effective or least costly alternative that solves the problem, that delaying problem. If there's another way to say that, maybe only considering the proportionate share of that or not considering the initial repayment.
Yeah, or perhaps a better
assessment
how many people might apply.
How many people in this?
Oh, they're not getting out of here without having testimony. they looked like deer in the headlights. Is that a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only thing I was going to say is that the discussion, I mean, they may want to run this as its own bill, too, because as a priority bill, because we may run into the same problem, you know, when the next bill comes over. We endanger it, and it might be a worthwhile bill. I'm sure it's a worthwhile bill. And, you know, it may be that in terms of consideration of the co-chairs, that it wouldn't hurt to have something drafted and in the wings just in case you needed to just go straight forward with the make the dash ones its own bill.
Actually, I perceive there's enough interest in this bill that if we communicate our interest to the co-chairs of Ways and Means, we'll find a way either get a priority bill together or we'll add this to the list with our personal recommendation that it move up in priority, and that will be helpful.
Well, we just had a nice little caucus last night, Mr. Chair, and I know Democrats are tax and spend. We spend the whole damn thing, but we're about $200 million apart from where they are now, and we haven't even seen the May forecast, so I don't know how this works.
Actually, I've repeatedly offered to lie about the revenue forecast if that'll help balance.
Mr. Chair.
Madam, if you have a question.
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say that I appreciate the testimony here this morning and reminding us of how bad service is for veterans in our country. And, you know, we keep hearing that we have a $1 trillion surplus at the federal level. It seems to me that, you know, for one of the priorities for that money should be making sure that our veterans get whatever services they need and that it, that they get them in a timely manner. Your stories about having to wait for all those years for even a response or a decision, that is outrageous. And it really, my colleague here and I were whispering to each other how mad it makes us to hear those stories. And anyway, I just appreciate you coming forward and sharing your experience with us and reminding us of we really need to turn that around and make some changes there. And we do have our state Veterans Affairs services here that we can have an effect on to try and step up and help people in our state, but at the federal level, certainly we, you know, I guess we can weigh in with our congressional delegation and everything, but boy, just very, very frustrating to hear your stories this morning.
Senator George. Well, it's not a question either, but, you know, I find it kind of interesting that our military folks can get an aircraft off a carrier in 4 seconds. We can get a missile out of a silo in just a matter of a couple minutes. We're talking about how many years?
17 years.
Maybe we need to put you guys in charge of this program.
Yeah, but it takes them 10 years to put the missile in.
Oh, okay. Colleagues, I think all of us feel that there's a few good issues that need to be addressed here, and we will try to address the first issue because we can do that today, and I would hate to be a delay consideration on House Bill 2282. For the reason that we have another very good issue, but we will commit to working on that other very good issue. Mr. Roach, I thank you for your testimony. It was excellent. And Mr. Bodenweiser and Mr. McDonald, I think as part of America's greatest generation, we really thank you for your service to our country and for your testimony here today. We will bring the folks from the Department of Revenue up and we'll have a little bit of discussion. I think the committee probably will move this good bill to the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Matt, thank you for working on the other two.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate it.
If we could have the folks from the Department of Revenue, and I guess in the briefest terms,
how do we pitch it?
The question. Well, I think we know how to fix it. It's just a matter of finding the resources. But the question I heard the good vice chair ask was, is there a more efficient way? Is there a less costly way? Is there a mechanism that you might recommend that would accomplish this goal for solving the problem that Mr. Roach brought forward, and that is the ability to deal with those folks that have a 70% disability?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue and Property Tax Division, and Shirley Leeper, also with our division. I haven't really been thinking about alternatives to that, but have you?
No, I have not. I just got the draft amendment a day or so ago.
Well, I'd like to ask then if you would review the draft amendment, consult with our staff here at Senate Revenue about impact, and draw on those resources that you might need to discuss the effect on local governments and see if there isn't a better or more efficient way we can offer some relief to veterans that have a 70% or more disability. Mr. Vice Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, one of the thoughts that I had that you may consider is it seems unfair to me that you take the entire repayment that goes back retroactive for a few years in consideration in doing it. I think it makes more sense to look at what the income will be. You know, will they qualify without that? So we may want to look at, or you may want to look at, suggesting that we don't consider those payments in that income determination.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Correct. And I think that might get it. And Elizabeth was suggesting that she thought that Mr. Roach, you know, those payments aside, under the bill that's coming across with the new income levels, coming up a little bit, might qualify under that.
Actually, Senator, I think you've got an excellent suggestion. If an administrative rule, the Department of Revenue could put a firewall between retroactive payments and consider those payments to be received in the year for which they were intended, it might make a big difference to people without a big effect on the revenue stream or the local governments or our ability to administer fairly a program meant to benefit veterans. So if I can restate that, if you have a retroactive payment, it shouldn't be considered income for the year in which it was received. It should be ascribed to the years for which it was intended, and that might lower the income for the existing year.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
My sense of the dash ones, if I understand, is where the really high impact or cost may be coming in, because it doesn't have any limitation on the income level. Mm-hmm. So you could make $1 million a year and still qualify under this amendment.
Right.
Maybe if we got back to the tone of the other one, where we're dealing with people who are financially strapped because of their disability.
Right. Well, excellent suggestion, Senator Pryor. Let me hear the reaction from the panel.
There are two notes I wanted to make, and if you wanted to bring the impact down a little bit, age was one of those comments. There's no age limit on this, whereas for the other two deferral programs, the senior and the disabled, there are income limits, and there are age limits. So if there's no age or income limits, this does increase the pool of people that would qualify and the direct cost of the program. I think the way I understand it, the dash ones simply add veterans to this deferral program, and it adds no age and income limit to that. And so I'm not sure if I understand your comments relative to the retroactivity relative to the dash ones. So I'm going to assume that you were referring to the bill itself.
Actually, the problem that was described in testimony by Mr. Roach was that when he finally did receive his retroactive or his disability determination on payments, his income exceeded the threshold by $165, and that was because the retroactive payments were included in the settlement. And
if
And I was just wondering if it had been ascribed differently by the department, if that would have made a difference in the determination.
Chairman and committee, for the record, I'm Shirley Leeper with the Department of Revenue. We would also then have possible situation where we have the people to get Social Security retroactive, and they can then apply the next year if they're over the income limit without paying that year's property taxes. If they're approved on the program, they can have those taxes held at the county indefinitely as long as they're still on the program.
Doesn't give them 3 years back.
It can be back 5 years if income tax. I mean property tax. If, for example, if John couldn't qualify this year because he was over the limit, now next year he should be able to qualify because on House Bill 2208 it raises that limit to 32,000 household, and then that will also be indexed. So hopefully next year he could meet the qualifications. If he does not have the resources or chooses not to pay his property taxes this November, he comes on deferral, he can have those property taxes held at the county.
So it's a dual benefit, if I can just interject. And then they get a deferral for future, in a future year when they would qualify, but they also get a delay of what's called a delay of foreclosure for delinquent taxes. So he would qualify for that also.
That's correct.
But under this one, he would have gotten, am I saying this right, reimbursed for not only the current year but the two previous years while his claim was pending? And in the situation you're describing, wouldn't he lose those retroactive portions?
Chair and Senator Byers, he would get future taxes only deferred if he had taxes still owing at the county, and it could be 4 or 5 years, they would be held at the county. we would not be able to go back and pick up those taxes under the deferral program.
But he also, by the same token, wouldn't go into foreclosure and lose his property because of that provision.
Okay, but then at some point when it comes out of deferral, the county would pick up those back taxes.
That's correct.
Colleagues, let's do the thing that we can do this morning, and that is go into work session on House Bill 2282. And the chair will accept a motion to move House Bill 2282 as drafted.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Vice Chair moves House Bill 2282 as drafted. Are there any questions on the motion? Hearing and seeing none, any objections to the motion? So moved. I would like to ask Senator Starr to carry on the Senate floor, if that's okay.
Glad to do that.
And Mr. Vice Chair, just to be clear, while Mr. Rush is here, the intent is still, as this other bill moves forward, to ask staff, Ms. Beth, to talk with Reverend and see if we can come up with a solution. I sense there's a sense of the will of the committee to do something.
Yeah, I would agree.
We've got to get that revenue impact down.
Yeah. I would agree with the Vice Chairman. Let's close the work session on House Bill 2282. I'd ask Department of Revenue staff to work with Representative Witt on the amendment that was brought to this bill for two purposes. One is to reduce the revenue impact. The other would be to prepare it for insertion into House Bill 2208, because we'll be hearing 2208 in our committee soon, and that's an appropriate vehicle. Any questions? Hearing and seeing none. Let's move on to the next bill. And again, I thank the folks that were here to testify on these issues today. It was excellent.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If we could move to House Bill 2278.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, House Bill 2278A. What this is doing is it's decreasing the personal property tax penalty from 100% to 50% of the personal property tax imposed if a filer paid taxes after August 1st or failed to file a personal property tax return at all. And it applies to tax years beginning 2203. So basically, there's been a recent survey the Department of Revenue did here in 2001 just on the makeup of personal property tax accounts that have penalties. And so what was revealed from this survey, and I've given you just a summary here by county of all your different personal property tax accounts, is 150,591 personal property tax accounts in the state. And then the total accounts with a penalty then is about 14,272, about 10% of the accounts in the state have some kind of penalty. And then when you look at the total amount of penalties, it's about 3.35 million in total penalties. And then you look at the breakdown. So basically with the personal property tax penalty structure, what it is it's graduated depending on when you actually are filing your personal property tax claim. And so you can receive a 5% penalty, a 25%, or 100%. And 100% is those who don't file at all or file after August 1st. And that's the subject of this particular bill, is just that 100% penalty. So right now, what we saw in 2001 is that there were 4,363, about 31% of the personal property tax accounts that had a penalty filed late, I mean, in the sense of after August 1st, or didn't file at all, and that value amount was about $2.36 million. So that's a large portion of the personal property tax penalties. What were these 100% penalties? About 71% of the total penalties collected by the counties were for 100% penalties on personal property tax accounts. And just so you're clear, too, these personal property tax penalties go to the county districts. Okay? It's not all local districts. It's just the county districts that collect this penalty. Now, the taxes, once they're actually paid, then those are distributed, you know, normally for all taxing districts. But just so you're clear, when we're changing this penalty structure, we're changing the amount of revenue that's going to county districts. So using these survey results, what you can see is that beginning in 2203, with an estimated annual growth of 3% for these personal property tax accounts, 1.2 million will be reduced in penalties on late property tax filers statewide from changing that rate from 100% to 50%. So basically, you're cutting that rate in half. And then in the 2003-05 biennium, it'll be up $2.54 million will be reduced from these collections. And again, this is for the counties only. And basically with these penalties, there was a graduated structure implemented in order to try to be an incentive for people to file at all. And this was changed, I think it was in the 95 session, to a graduated penalty, depending on how long it took you to actually file.
Questions on the orientation? Let us open the public hearing on House Bill 2278 and call forward to Mr. J.L. Wilson. We'll open the public hearing.
Thank you, Chair Farioli, members of the committee. My name is J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB, and I didn't request the bill, but I do need to support it on behalf of my members, because my educated guess is that those who are the 3% or so of personal property tax filers who are assessed the 100% penalty, my guess is, my educated guess is a fair number of them, probably a disproportionate number, have the NFIB placard in their windows. And the reason that I support that is because based on the number of calls in my office, I'll get, well, what's this personal property tax, or how was I supposed to know I was liable for this? And my only point quickly is that it's not like the income tax where it's readily evident that it's something that they're liable to pay. I use the illustration of two people, and they both have the same computer, telephone, or scanner and desk in their office. One person uses it for personal use. The other person uses it to engage in business of some sort. Well, person two, the person who engages in business, you know, that's taxable property to them. And it may not be readily evident that it is, and furthermore, their obligation to pay or file that tax may not be readily evident. So I don't deny that there should be a penalty or sanction against late filing, but in light of the fact that it is not readily evident, and therefore I think that most late filings to that degree are probably inadvertent. Now, the point I want to make is these people aren't scofflaws. They just didn't know. So for that reason, I do support House Bill 2278. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Wilson? I, too, have had constituents who have contacted me who have, in fact, inadvertently failed to file and have received notification of 100% tax penalty and have appealed to the local tax authorities and have been told that that is the statutory requirement for a penalty for late filing. Mm-hmm. So this would certainly give a little latitude to in reducing that penalty, authorize a reduction, and also I can understand the disincentive of a 100% penalty for people filing tax forms at all. Questions from the committee? Mr. Vice Chair?
This may be for the revenue folks.
Then let's have
2124 that came out of the 97 session. Also, beyond imposing the 100% penalty, it also allowed the County Board of Property Tax Appeals to waive the penalty for good cause.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's correct.
No good causes.
And I don't know the results of all the Board of Property Tax Appeals
those were local
decisions, but Diane. And
I thought Diane might want to.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Diane Belt, I'm the Washington County Personal Property Tax Collector. Basically, when it comes to this penalty, you also need to realize that after we get the initial filing, which is due on March the 1st, like in our county, we just got done sending out letters to all those who did not file a return that had filed one in previous years, informing them that there's now a penalty. Then if we don't get a return, we send out another letter that says we still haven't gotten your return and there's now a new penalty. And then we send out a certified letter that says you haven't filed your return at all. In our county, and I can't speak for other counties, we do personally call all of these businesses to find out if they still, in fact, are in business to see what the problem is. So we take that extra step. As far as the appeals, I'm not real sure in our county. I do know that I did see some appeals come through on the penalty, but I'm not sure that ignorance of the law is something that...
So Diane, you're just notifying the people who had filed in a previous year?
That's Mr. Chair, Senator Bryce, correct.
So in terms of the previous speaker's comments, people who don't know at all wouldn't know until they tripped up, called, or something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, a lot of those folks we run across, like if a title company or an attorney or a sale is transpiring, they'll call the office to check on personal property, and then we'll see that they have not filed.
I see.
And they are subject then to omitted property back to the years that they were in business plus the penalty.
If I might, and I didn't identify myself for the record, John Phillips, Department of Revenue, that we didn't advocate for this bill to increase the percentage back in when it was at 97 or whenever it went up, and we're not advocating for this bill either. But it's just, I think the committee should know that there are people who, there was a big problem with people not filing and people that were aware of it. And the 100% penalty came in and was applied. And what counties would call and tell me was, and our personal property folks, is that, you know, it's really strange that somebody would pay the 100% penalty and the following year they don't file. And they pay the 100% penalty and the following year they still don't file. So, you know, in one way, it didn't work. Because they still don't file.
Sounds like in every way it didn't.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I'm just saying a lot of people are filing now that weren't before. You know, I'd have to agree with JL. There's people that are hit that, you know, either unaware. And I don't know whether it's a small number of people that are paying it that are unaware. I would suspect that's true. But 100% sounds large.
Question? Senator Clifford.
Well, I have two questions. One is, I mean, if you look at Lane County, 312 account at the 100% penalty, $191,000, there would seem to be some considerable staff work going into having to do that renotice of people that they haven't paid.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, yeah, there's an awful lot of staff work involved.
Right. Mr. Chair, and then my
second...
I
don't think they do this.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for what the other counties do. I can tell you that's what we do.
Let's talk about your county then.
Sure.
Yeah, let's talk about your county. So what county is that?
Washington County.
So you don't have... In fact, you sent a notice that seems to indicate that you don't have much of a problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, our personal property role has been pretty... No, we don't have a lot of problem, but... I would say I'm like John. It amazes me. I know Mr. Wilson talked about the small businesses. The penalties I see are typically on big businesses, and they don't call, they don't complain, and they don't file, but they pay.
And so, Mr. Chair, there would be some indication in that then that this isn't people caught unaware, naive people caught unaware of their responsibility to pay their personal property taxes. This is a strategy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I believe it was intended to be a strategy, but I'm like John, I'm not sure that how well it worked.
No, my point is that it's a strategy on the part of the business.
Oh.
If they're, you know, paying one year, avoiding the next, paying one year, avoiding the next, that would seem to be a pattern to me.
Well,
Senator Corcoran, it's not that they're paying the taxes. What I understood is that they were paying the 100% penalty.
I know, that's what I mean. That's my point.
So they pay the penalty and the tax.
Yeah.
My point is they're not ignorant of the fact that they have the responsibility.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, my personal opinion is that their return is not filed properly, that they probably have a lot more value out there than they have been willing to report, and that's why they pay.
Thank you.
But that's my personal opinion.
It's a discounted...
So here's my other question, and I know you can't speak for other counties, but maybe the Department of Revenue can answer this more appropriately, but aren't there, like, I thought there was all kinds of small business assistance information out there, whether it's the bank or loaning institution that's going to help finance the small business or, you know, small business loans, that from the tax side of it, that there's plenty of public information out there telling people what their tax responsibilities are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, the personal property tax people in our department have told me, and I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but they've told me that there is information available out there and where at the point at which those small businesses are coming online or getting up, that there is information about, hey, by the way, there is a state personal property tax. I haven't seen those forms myself, but that's my understanding.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just amazed this thing got out of the House the way it did. That's pretty amazing to me.
Senator Beyer.
Diane, maybe you can help me. We raised the, for this very purpose, at the request of the assessors last session, we raised the threshold when businesses would have to do this. Didn't we raise it to 20 or 25,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it was $10,000 is the limit. A lot of small businesses actually, I just was for another bill that I think you'll be hearing at some point in time. I did an analysis in Washington County because there is a bill currently in the works that's going to raise that limit. Basically, in our county, anything that's $10,000 and under is typically your smaller business, your in-home business, you know, somebody that has a computer copy machine. I know we have a little office at our house, and thinking of what the value is, it's well under $10,000. So a lot of the small businesses already are not paying that tax.
I can't remember if it was your boss or if it was Tom that was in last time. The assessors had a bill and said they want to get the threshold up so that our cost of processing doesn't exceed our
Mr. Chair, Senator.
I think there's another bill in this time to raise that again.
Yes, there is. There is.
There's
right.
House Bill 2111 would raise that to 12.5. The original bill said from 10,000 to 20,000, and they resolved it by agreeing on 12.5 and then indexing it.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good. 20 to 12.5.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe the $10,000 threshold was developed, and that's what they determined the assessors as to how much it cost to process, how much tax was levied, and it was kind of a wash at that point.
Let's see, why aren't counties here to testify?
Why aren't some counties here?
May or may not matter to the committee, but it passed with a unanimous vote of those present in the House.
Are you going to testify?
It's not a big deal.
So, I'd like you to testify because I want to hear about what your position on it is, since it looks like it has a sizable impact on counties.
Mister, please don't give my taxes away. Come on down.
Yeah. Yeah. Mister, please don't give any unfunded mandates.
I can see that the association is eager to weigh in.
Mister, $2.365 million in impact. Let us know what you think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. I should say first that Gil Riddell is the one that works these areas. He is in another committee testifying and working on easements, so asked me to sit in. I do know this much, that we had worked with the representative who sponsored this bill, and I believe, if I'm correct, it was adjusted down to 50%, and there was agreement with that. Not that we, I guess, I think we do agree that the 100% penalty is onerous, and it doesn't work, I guess is maybe the better word, and that it wasn't something that we were involved with originally in any, at least the Association of Oregon Counties wasn't. The assessors probably were, and others when this was established, but agreed that 50% made sense. And if I remember, it also relates to the same figure that's used in the income tax side. Am I correct? I think that it's parallel, if I remember correctly. Somebody, I think Gil mentioned that to me, and so thought that symmetry there made sense, and so we were okay with that.
That's well, good. I hope we don't hear any more from the counties than ever again.
No,
I mean, it's $2.5 million, and
I know
the county's just sitting there going, "Yeah, fine, do it to us," you know. And they scream like hell if we do anything else. I just wonder what's going on here. You know, be consistent, at least.
I guess, Mr. Cantan, I would ask if my name is Peter.
Absolutely.
Am I correct in assuming that the decision that the county's probably made is that you're more likely to get participation with a high but more reasonable fine than the 100%, which was deemed onerous?
Mr. Chair, that I would think that's correct. I'd have to talk to Mr. Riddell because I haven't gotten into the detail on this bill. But I also think that there was the issue was, could you defend the 100%? penalty? I mean, what,
I think, Kim, the case that Diane was putting out there, where people were fined and then don't come back the next year and file again, that's pretty clear tax, attempted tax evasion.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not even sure that's true, Mr. Vice Chairman, because if you are fined, you certainly are in the tax roll. So not filing the following year is like becoming invisible. Obviously, you're in the tax roll.
Tax evasions have needs too, Mr. Chair. Jeez.
It's either evasion or stupid outrage.
Mr. Chair, if I could, this was not a bill that we proposed. I try to respond to Senator Corcoran.
I'm underwhelmed by that thing.
And so it...
Colleagues, we will be closing the public session instantaneously, and we'll be hearing another good bill that we have before the committee in the form of House Bill 2103. Public hearing is closed.
I knew the rich had needs. I didn't know tax evaders had needs.
Let us have an orientation to House Bill 2103.
Try another one.
When you think about the bills, when you think about the bills that aren't getting heard this session, it's amazing what gets heard.
Liz Guthrie, are you feeling a little bit like you're in front of the Senate Rules Committee?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2103, this is dealing with the Rural Enterprise Zone Program. And basically, this is doing it's extending the sunset on the long-term rural enterprise zone to December 31st of 2004. And it's going through and it's reorganizing these long-term rural enterprise zone statutes, and it is making it clearer and just moving sections of it so it's chronologically easier to read. It is creating a long-term enterprise zone fund, and then it takes effect 21 days after adjournment. So just to kind of go through some of the basics again with this program, this is not the same as your short-term enterprise zone program, your 3 to 5 year property tax exemption. This is different. This was created in 1997, and what it is doing is basically allowing cities and counties to apply to the Economic Community Development Department to be a sponsor of this enterprise zone, rural enterprise zone, and then you have to make substantial investments, which the amount of the investment is going to depend on where the facility is located within the state, but the investment must be the lesser of $50 million or 1% of the net real market value of the property value in the county. And then you have hiring criteria where the firm has to hire at least 75 full-time employees by the end of 5 years, and then there has to be worker compensation that must be at least 50% above the average county wage. Basically, the value then of those eligible firms and the new investment that is brought into these enterprise zones, and the value is exempt from property tax for at least 7 years or up to 15 years after the facility is completed. Then while the property value is in the construction period, it is not placed on the property tax roll. The investment then must be in these counties which are chronic unemployment or chronic low employment. And then in addition to that property tax, longer-term property tax exemption, you also then have the corporations can receive an income tax credit. And that's what makes it different than the short-term. And this is equal to 62.5% of the taxpayer's payroll and the employee benefit costs at the facilities. So this credit is going to apply to liabilities above a certain amount, and that's going to depend on the location of the facility again, with an overall threshold of $1 million. So the credit can range from 5 to 15 years, and that is determined by the governor. The credit can be carried forward for 5 years, and there were quite a few changes that were made in Senate Bill 245. To this program on last session, and one of the changes that was brought in is dealing with local governments in the sense that 30% of all the taxes then that are paid by the taxpayer who is receiving this income tax credit are then distributed to local districts which would have received those property taxes from this facility, with the exception of school districts. So again, any business that is going to be making this substantial investment in this rural enterprise zone area has to be approved by the governor's office in order to get that income tax credit. Right now, we, in I know Economic Community Development is here, but at this time, that there's just one company that's expected to use on this expenditure. There may be others, but the one company is a forest products plant in Douglas County, which is currently completing construction, and it will be starting that 15-year property tax exemption. So it is currently not on the property tax roll because it's under construction. The loss in local revenues in Douglas County is uncertain, but it's estimated about $350,000 per year when it does actually get completed. And then the income tax component, which would be a reduction in state government, general fund money, is estimated at about $2.6 million, and that corresponds to a payroll estimate of about $4.1 million.
Questions from the committee on the orientation? Hearing none, let us bring forward Mr. Burton and Steve Vincent. And any other persons who wish to offer testimony. I will open the public hearing for House Bill 2103. Good morning.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, good morning. Staff did an excellent job of providing an overview of the bill. One thing she left off is an unintended consequence of this bill, which I'll bring up in light of the previous hearing, and that is that everyone who receives an enterprise zone benefit files a property tax return. 100% requirement. I thought I'd do a quick overview of the enterprise zone program in general, and then talk on, very briefly, given the staff orientation, on the specifics of this bill. Enterprise zone is a local option, or enterprise zone program is a local option business incentive program. It exists for up to 48 zones throughout the state. That's a legislatively determined number. Currently, there are 44 active zones. There are four zones that have never been awarded that were approved in the last session, and we're probably heading for a round that will distribute the balance of those zones. The zone benefits are for new investment in industrial, wholesale, and by further local decision, hotel-motel developments in the enterprise zones. They come with a 3-year forgiveness of real and personal property taxes. If the businesses pay exceptionally well for the counties they build in, they can earn an additional 1 or 2 years of exemption, which are also a local option. The Rural Long-Term Enterprise Zone program was a creation, as you heard, of the 97 legislature. It was updated in 99. This bill, and the point of the program is to provide an appropriately sized counterpart to the strategic investment program, which is available throughout the state, but the realities are that the level of investment needed to trigger strategic investment program benefit are of an order that's rarely going to be seen in rural Oregon. So the point of this bill and the refinements has been to tailor the size of an exceptional investment to the community that the investment would be located in. And of course, appropriately, therefore, there are conditions related to the population of the community and the level of distress of the community and income levels. I think if you had questions of me, I've said enough, and I'll turn it over to the other folks.
Mr. Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. I guess I'm here to represent the collective interests of the Oregon Economic Development Association. This is an association of economic development professionals from the South Coast to Eastern Oregon to Central Oregon. I guess simply put, they're the Lee Byers of the state. Those folks who are...
That kills it.
Yeah. These are the folks who are trying to help businesses expand or recruit businesses into their jurisdictions. And I just want to be here to encourage your support of this bill on behalf of that association. I'd like to give you one really quick example of what the enterprise zone can do for a community. Now, this will be an example of the short term, but just to show you what its impact has been. Over Labor Day weekend in 1998, The Boise Cascade plant in Medford, the company's largest plywood and veneer mill in the West, burned to the ground, the entire facility. Now, the company simply could not pencil it out to rebuild the facility, and so we were at risk of losing 450 family wage jobs at $35,000 a year and about a $16 million annual payroll impact on the community. A community team was put together using the short-term enterprise zone program, was able to aid Boise Cascade in making it pencil out to rebuild the plant. And I just want to use that as an example as to why the enterprise zone program is important to rural communities. Of course, it's used statewide, and of course, this this program in 2103 we are talking about is for a little less common circumstance than what I may have given you. But just urge your passage of the bill. Thank you.
Questions? Mr. Vice Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, having dealt with this a lot in the economics and investment business, I'll tell you that from personal experience, what is true is that Oregon has the least incentives. In fact, probably you could say the worst incentive program, all things packaged together, than any of the 11 states. We're basically non-competitive if that's the game. My sense, and it gets even worse if you're talking about a rural area, it takes you literally a hammer and crowbar to get someone to even consider getting more than 5 miles off Interstate 5. I've worked with a lot in my areas in Oak Ridge and Florence and to some degree Cottage Grove. It's very hard to get anybody to consider it. And from a business perspective, it almost never makes any sense to go outside of the urban communities. So I think this program makes sense. It's had very little impact since 97 when we put it in place. Contrast that with the strategic investment program that has worked very well in getting its intended purposes, very large investments. I think it makes sense. The question I would ask is it targeted too high? I think the $50 million, unless you're talking about a something, I think the lumber products operation that was referenced in the report, that makes sense, natural resources to be there. But I wonder if this should be lower. From my experience, the average industrial investment in Oregon and the discount don't consider things like chip plants, silicon chip plants, or large metals things are in the $15 to $25 million range. And those are the more realistic things. I think this target, again, remembering it's permissive, should be lower than that. If we really care about rural communities, we ought to give them a tool recognizing it's permissive that is lower than this. This is an unrealistic level for most of them.
Chair Farioli, Senator Beyer. I think the criticism is well stated. I think I should have pointed out the rest of my attachments that are kind of on the back side. First, there is a map that identifies where zones, these rural benefits may be delivered through existing zones. And on the back side of that, there's a schedule that sort of lays out the sliding scale where we fit the size of the investment of the community. These are large investments. This is a program that offers extraordinary incentives for extraordinary investments. Additionally, investments in which the employees will receive exceptional pay. This is a big deal, and it's meant to have a fairly high threshold. The standard enterprise zone, by contrast, does not have a threshold, a realistic threshold for the level of investment. It actually does have a threshold, but it's small enough so any construction project is basically going to qualify. Further, the standard enterprise zone program has, I think, an additional usefulness in that, this is a conversation we've had before related to family wage jobs, but rural and distressed parts of the state are often typified by unemployment at the double digit level. The labor market there describes that you don't have to pay the same kind of wages you do in Portland, Eugene, Corvallis. So The basic enterprise zone program, which addresses normal investment, doesn't have what I consider to be a wage penalty for rural Oregon. Not that we don't want to see good pay throughout the state. That's really the goal. We're trying to create enough pressure on the labor market, enough demand to soak up the slack and drive up wages in general. In those parts of the states that are really hurting, there's 10 or 15% unemployment. We need to see any investment, any activity in the labor market, and for that there's the normal program. This is an exceptional program, so it does have high limits.
Mr. Church.
Question, Senator Corcoran?
Well, looking at that chart, long-term rural enterprise tax incentives, is it the Roberts Creek in Douglas County that was the $50 million threshold that is the only company that took advantage of this?
Chair Perioli, Senator Corcoran, the company was Roseburg Lumber Company. Had two investments, actually. We allowed for multiple investments to reach the threshold, as which was a barrier, as Senator Beyer indicates. We do have another potential of a recruitment prospect that could be looking at locating in either Klamath Falls or Roseburg, both of which would, and it's a $125 million investment, I believe, and would trigger this, the potential for this sort of benefit. Something that needs to be repeated is that this is this extraordinary benefit is at a local option. It's negotiated locally, and if there's an income tax incentive also, that's negotiated with the state.
Mr. Chair, so but I guess I'm confused by the $1 million in the minimum annual state taxes paid. Is that an assumption that's not just hasn't come to fruition yet? Is that why that's there? The others are all listed per job except for the Grants Pass and the two South Douglas and Sutherland.
Members of the committee, Senator Corcoran, Vice Chair Beyer, my name is Art Fish. I'm currently on rotation with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, working on Fairview and Damish, but previously I was with the Economic Community Development Department as the Enterprise Zone Coordinator for the state, and I'm here today to assist Mr. Burton. Just to explain, it's kind of important. When this started out in 1997, you may remember that was Nucor and Coos Bay and something that never really happened. And some of the thresholds were set very high. I think, you know, it had to be at least $50 million wherever it went and 100 jobs and so forth. In 1999, which is really when this program first started to be perhaps realistic for most parts of the state, if you will, this gradation was introduced so that depending upon the size of the county and whatnot, the thresholds were lower, and you can see that. And so really it's only along the I-5 corridor that you would still have the $50 million. And that does apply in the case of the Riddle plant that Mike referred to. And that's probably fairly reasonable for those decent locations. Go to Wallowa County or Burns or someplace. You know, a big investment might be big and still be a lot smaller than elsewhere. The credit begins, and for many companies, even big corporations, there aren't a whole lot to pay $1 million in taxes anyway. But there are some, and the credit can begin after they've paid that first $1 million. They can use the credit, which could easily exceed their remaining liability, but they can use it at least for the remainder of that liability. What it's based on is it's either, or I should say, when that credit begins. It used to be set at $1 million, and it still is in some of those places right near the corridor, like you see here. But for some of the others, that threshold or that threshold above which the credit can be taken might begin at a lower level, and it's just a multiple of the number of employees that they have, and the idea being that the more employees they have, the more likely that they're impinging on school districts. So, you know, we should at least get some amount of income taxes from them before they can start using the credit. But, you know, if they're only having 10 jobs, if they only meet the minimum of 10 jobs, say, in Grant County or Lakeview, then it might just start at $100,000. And then above that, they can take the credit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
And that's the taxes, not the income. It's the actual tax.
All right, Mike, I want to be real clear, though, that people understand this. These are what we would call but-for taxes. But for the incentive, there wouldn't be any jobs, there wouldn't be any taxes at all. And I think that's a big, my experience has been is that is a really big but-for in rural areas. And the demonstration of that is this. The chairman talks about a lot when he brings up the chart that shows the rural unemployment rates. It's very hard to get anything to happen in a rural community.
Charlie, yes. Let's come to closure on this bill. The House bill before us does three things. It's a revamp of the enterprise zone process. It's an extension of the time period during which business firms can be certified. It's the creation of a new long-term enterprise zone with an extremely high threshold for participation. The revenue impacts are indeterminate because the facilities that might be considered, that we know of one, and it isn't up and running yet, and in any case, approval from the governor's office would be necessary for the income tax credit to be granted. There's one expected to be using this program in the future, but even that is online on an indeterminate schedule. This creates a new long-term tool. In other words, it's very targeted, very high threshold. The redefinition and the refocus and the extension, I think, are issues that are all worthy of consideration. My inclination is to go ahead and move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation because we, even if we were to send it to Ways and Means immediately, they couldn't determine what the revenue impact would be. That would be in the future, and it would be pending the completion of some facility that, but for this good tool, wouldn't exist. So,
no interest in lowering that $50 million down?
I guess I would call up the person from the Economic Development Department to talk about the possibility of lowering that threshold.
Chairman,
will you
come in?
Yes,
sure. Well, I'm intrigued about Senator Beyer's idea, particularly relative to the fact that we do have so many areas now that are staying 10 to 15% unemployment. And if in fact we have not provided the proper incentives to get anybody to go there, you may want to consider moving that to a level that you might encourage job creation in those areas.
What would you think about 25 million?
I'll tell you what we're going to do.
Chair Farrelly, Senator Beyer, you guys are in the seat of passing policy. We believe that we're talking large investments. $25 million is still a large investment, particularly for some of the communities we're talking about, John Day being a good case in point.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Senator Sorkin?
So you must get inquiries, Mike, from, you know, a variety of you know, levels of size of program. I mean, are you getting requests under 50 million, projects under 50 million, and then you tell them what the, you know, the enterprise tax benefits are, and, you know, if it was 50 million, it would be enhanced. I mean, you get folks under the 50 million, I would assume.
Chair Farrelly, Senator Corcoran, we get a lot of, we're not right now getting a lot. I mean, the economy's turned down and things have slowed down. And we get very few of these very large projects that, I mean, part of the implicit in a very large project is a very large labor impact, and most of these communities couldn't deal with that. That's one of the reasons why it's important to gradate this relative to the community. A big deal in Lakeview or Burns or John Day is not the same thing as a big deal in Coos Bay, for that matter, but certainly not compared to Portland. Most of the very large projects we see want to be in a large labor market with a lot of people. We don't get a lot of these, and when we do, this is a very compelling tool. We talked about the fact that it's difficult to do business from rural Oregon. You got to want to. This makes a big difference on the bottom line when they're doing their analysis, because it comes off of the front end when you're doing your net present value computations and whatnot. It makes a big difference. $25 million would be at the pleasure of the committee, and the department would be fine with that. As you can see with our sliding standard, most of the communities are already under that.
Would it help you relocate businesses in smaller communities?
Chair Farrelly, Senator Beyer, it would for the right business.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's one of those things that fits like a key in a lock if the right business comes along. I don't know of a community that wouldn't welcome 75 full-time employees in a five-year period or 35 initially, especially at 150% of the average wage in the county where it was located. But in many of the counties that we're seeing, the need in the average wage is $10,000 to $15,000 or half the urban wage. So it's not going to be, you know, if you find a business that fits this thing, I'm certain it would be welcome in any of these districts.
And it is permissive to the local community. Yeah.
Let's go to work session on the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair?
I move a conceptual amendment to reduce the threshold from $50 million to $25 million.
Mr. Vice Chair, I see that on page 4, section 3, line 14, is that the only place in the bill that it appears?
I hear Judy coming down the hallway right now.
Well, that's easy. Does that work? Just do it that way?
I think if we make the conceptual amendment to make the changes consistent throughout the bill with lowering to $50 million, you'll be safe.
Okay.
Doris is retired now. She has plenty of time on her hands. She can fix it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, in order to consider a conceptual amendment, the chair will accept a motion to suspend the rule for
Remove, Mr. Chair,
the purpose
mistake.
Of making a conceptual amendment. Does everybody understand the motion? Anybody object to the motion? Rules are suspended for the specific purpose of making a conceptual amendment. Mr. Vice Chair.
Now, Mr. Vice Chair, I would move that the threshold throughout the bill be consistently reduced from $50 million to $25 million.
Any questions on the motion?
Just a comment.
A comment?
The comment is that, keep in mind as we look at this, a couple of things. One, it is permissive. The local government will make the decision whether they want to participate or not in the program, and that it's all speculative revenue. There will be no revenue if the siding doesn't happen.
Right.
Objections to the conceptual motion? Hearing and seeing none, so moved. Mr. Vice Chair?
Yeah, I'm just doing the same for you.
That's the same as 15.
I think there's enough direction to let
that was included in the motion, line 19 on.
Yeah, we never made a specific line reference.
Oh, you didn't make
it. It was just to make it consistent.
With 25 million. Chair will accept a motion to move the bill as conceptually amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2103 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The Vice Chair moves 2103 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? So ordered, and guess what?
Mr. Vice Chair.
I'll trade you.
We are in a
I don't even represent a rural area.